Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we have Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Sean McFate, author of Shadow War, the first in a series of thriller fiction in the vein of Tom Clancy. It's the story of an elite American mercenary on a secret mission to save a businessman's family in Eastern Europe, possibly tipping the balance of power between Russia and the United States. And much of the action in the novel, by the way, came from the author's own experiences. It actually started off as a memoir. Later in the program, I'll be speaking with David Morgan about his new book, Monty Python Speaks, with interviews from all the original cast and more. It's a look at an amazing and silly 30-year spree in TV and film, though the timing of the release hits a 50th anniversary as well. We're going to start with an art exhibit revolving around motorcycles and motorcycle culture. We have Taylor Milliner in conversation with Rebecca Trowick, curator for Faster Faster and curator and director at the Wignall Museum on the campus of Chaffey College.
The beauty of my job is there is no regular day to day. As director and curator, my jobs shift back and forth constantly. Mm-hmm. So I'm both looking at the institution's big picture. I'm representing the museum at the college and in the community, like I'm doing here today. And then as a curator, I'm also doing the day-to-day operations related to exhibitions. Okay. So every day is different. It might be getting ready for a reception or a public event. It might be installing an exhibition, working with our exhibitions preparator, training staff, attending meetings on campus.
So every day is completely different.
Yes, which is part of what I love about the job.
Right, that's exciting. Okay, so are you able to explain to everyone what exactly a curator is and your role as being one?
Yes, that's a question I get often out in the world when I tell people what I do. They immediately think it's very fancy, which it sounds fancy, but like any job, it's real work.
It's fancy.
It's kind of fancy. But yeah, as a curator, right, you're the person who's conceiving of an idea for an exhibition and you're making it happen. And so it's like from concept to completion. So right. I have an idea. I'm finding artists. I'm working with budgets and staff. Mm-hmm. I'm planning ahead. You know, we usually plan a couple years in advance. So
a couple years, you said?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Ideally, wow. So that we have time to program, that we have time to reach out to faculty on campus to create mm-hmm. connections mm-hmm. in the classroom so that it really benefits our students.
So then how long has this exhibit taken place? How long have you guys been planning this?
Oh, let me think. It's actually a little bit of a shorter lead time. And I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. I think we've been discussing it for a little over a year, maybe a year and a half.
Okay, so it is a little shorter.
Yeah, and the reason is that this exhibition was actually supposed to happen last summer.
Oh.
But the Wignall Museum has been under construction with a remodeling project that went over a bit. So it got pushed back.
Right. Oh, interesting.
So our entire schedule was pushed forward into the future.
Exactly. Okay. So can you describe how life has led you to be a curator? What were you doing before this project?
Well, I've been at Chaffey College for 17 years. Yeah, I've just had my anniversary last week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And so I started there as the assistant curator. Okay. The Wignall Museum is a very small institution. We have three full-time staff, myself, an assistant curator, and a preparator.
Wow.
In addition, we do have a number of students who work with us as front desk staff and security in the museum. So we have a rotating group of anywhere from 6 to 10 who assist us in that capacity. So previously, I was working on other exhibitions.
Okay.
Right? So I've been there quite some time. So.
Okay. So Faster Faster is an exhibit that brings together contemporary artists and designers who contemplate the motorcycle in their work. Can you tell us what inspired you to curate this exhibit? Was there a particular piece that inspired you, or was it just a general idea?
So this exhibition actually came to me through a colleague, Sheila Malone, who is a professor of technical theater at Chaffey College. She's the editor of the International Journal for Motorcycle Studies, which is a peer-reviewed scholarly journal. They take submissions, and it's made up of a group of people who are in academics and in other industries, but who are passionate about motorcycle studies.
Right. That's very interesting, actually. Yeah. Super interesting.
So I mentioned that the exhibition was meant to happen last summer. Mm-hmm. She planned their conference to happen at Chaffey College last July. And so the exhibition was meant to coincide, but we weren't able to do that, unfortunately.
Right.
But at that point, we'd already planned the exhibition, mm-hmm. and so Right. You know, we just were able to push it forward.
Right.
So we participated and assisted in the conference regardless. Mm-hmm. Really, it was her idea. She said, hey, I want to plan this conference. The institution is game. Are you? Would mm-hmm. you be interested in curating something to coincide? And so at that point, I thought, why not? That sounds great.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Right. So then would you consider yourself a motorcycle enthusiast?
No, I'm actually not a rider.
Okay.
No.
So this
kind of scare me. Even though,
funny.
I mean, I think they're beautiful. I think all of the art, you know.
Okay. So this is literally an idea that
really
was brought to you.
Yeah.
So you don't ride motorcycles.
I don't.
Have you ever ridden a motorcycle?
I've been a passenger. Is that the right term?
It's passenger. A motorcycle passenger.
Yeah.
That's funny. Okay. Well, that's interesting. That's great.
Yeah.
How did you pick the artists that are featured in this exhibit? Can you take us through this process?
Sure. So like with any exhibition, there's the idea and then there's the challenge of finding artists who are working in that area. So part of it is just being aware, seeing as much artwork as I can, doing research constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So I took recommendations from Sheila as a jumping off point. Mm-hmm. You know, I do research online. I read a number of books, went to see exhibitions, and you know, the internet, you can go down a rabbit hole. And so
right.
I was able to find a lot of interesting avenues to explore.
Right.
And there's always artists who we would like to show, but we can't, either because the work isn't available, shipping is too much. We're a small institution, so
right.
every institution has
exactly.
limits and capacities.
Exactly, limitations.
So, yeah.
So did you know any of the artists before?
Let's see. I did know, a few. Yeah, Deborah Asheim. I'm familiar with her work. I did a studio visit with her years ago.
Okay.
And so I was familiar and knew that she'd done some work that coincided with this theme.
Okay.
Sean Duffy, he showed at the Wignall Museum, I want to say in 04 or 06,
okay.
in an exhibition that a former colleague curated called Drive Time.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I was familiar with his body of work. Oh, and then Max Grundy, he's a Riverside-based artist and car designer.
Oh, that's and interesting.
And I'm familiar with his work because my husband has two custom cars, and we go to car shows all the time. So I knew Max's work from car shows.
Right. So then did you know of their motorcycle-driven art? Did this have to do with motorcycles, like their art specifically, or?
Well, Max's work primarily deals with custom cars. But I loved his work. It's really graphic and bold. And I said, hey, have you ever done a painting of a motorcycle? And he said, as a matter of fact, I have. So I was really happy to hear that and
what
include
a great
his
coincidence.
Work. Yeah, yeah. You know, because there's often a lot of crossover in the car
right.
and motorcycle
mm-hmm.
world.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then Sean's work, he often works with machinery. He's
okay.
done work with cars, motorcycles, record players.
Okay.
So I'd
this
known
was
that.
Perfect for the exhibit.
Yes,
okay.
yes. And then Deborah, she shared some recent work with me, and her drawing in the exhibition features an image of a Hell's Angel at the 1967 San Francisco Golden Gate Park human be-in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that was an interesting sort of unexpected avenue to explore in the exhibition as well.
Very interesting. Can you tell me what the struggles were to make all of this happen?
Well, with any exhibition, the challenge is getting the work that you really want, that feeds your concept. You know, dealing with budget constraints and time and connecting with artists can be challenging if they're quite busy.
So those were your main struggles, is pretty much just finding the art that fulfilled your vision?
Yeah, I think that's always the challenge.
Right.
You know, and making it, you know, some kind of cohesive narrative. So
right.
the viewer comes in and sort of understands
exactly what you guys are trying to.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Got it. What came together the easiest? Even surprised you how easy it was?
Well, I'm always pleasantly surprised at the generosity of artists. They're the hardest working people I know.
Right.
They're incredibly smart.
They really are.
They really are. Incredibly smart and really generous. You know, we don't pay artists to show in an exhibition. And so, you know, we try to offer other perks. You know, we create a small printed piece. We do a number of programs, meaning film screenings, lectures, art discussions, roundtables, those kinds of things.
Okay.
And we can offer a modest honoraria for that.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so I'm always really pleasantly surprised at how willing artists are to participate.
We love artists.
Yes,
artists
we do.
Are great people.
Absolutely, yes.
Can you take us through what a person will see at the exhibit once they walk through the door? What exactly should we expect?
Sure. So the exhibition is made up primarily of paintings, drawings, and reproductions, meaning screen prints, etc. And then there is some sculpture and video included in the exhibition as well.
So it's literally everything.
Yeah.
Oh.
But what it isn't, you know, some people may come in and say, where are the motorcycles?
Oh, right.
Literally, right?
So
they're depicted a great deal, but we don't actually have motorcycle as sculpture included in the exhibition.
Oh.
I kind of wanted to take it another direction and really focus on 2D work primarily.
Okay.
Although there is some 3D and video as well.
Okay. Wow. That's so fun. How about the physical space itself? Mm-hmm. Are there rooms separated by the types of art, or is it one big room? Can you paint that picture for us?
Sure, sure. When you walk in our new front door, which is fabulous, and you see our new lobby. Yeah, we do have one large exhibition space, and we do also have a small ancillary space that is sometimes used in exhibitions, but it isn't in this case. It's not being used to show art. It is a reading room. So we have a library of books related to motorcycle culture, many of which I read to conduct research for the exhibition.
How many books would you say?
There's maybe 20, 25.
Mm-hmm. You had 25 motorcycle books?
Well, I didn't read them all.
Oh, you didn't read them all.
I read a number of them.
We had to be specific.
Yes.
Very interesting that you said 25 books, so I had to ask. Would you say you're an artist yourself?
Well, that is what I pursued in my own education.
Oh, really?
It was actually visual arts.
Visual
so arts. I always say I'm a little bit of a lapsed visual artist. I hope to get back to it someday.
I hope you do. I hope you do.
But I feel like curating really fulfills a lot of my creative
pursuit.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you hope to expand this exhibit to other locations? Will any of these pieces appear elsewhere?
We don't have plans to travel the exhibition, so you may be able to see the works elsewhere, but probably not
currently
the full exhibition.
Okay. Right? Okay. Yeah. With trying to get the word out for this exhibit, has anyone contacted any motorcycle clubs or organizations?
Yeah, we have publicized the exhibition with a number of organizations in the region.
What specific piece of art has had the biggest impact on your life?
So in, I want to say about 1990, I was living in Minneapolis. That's where I went to school. And I went to the Walker Art Center and saw an exhibition of Fluxus art.
Wow.
And that really blew my mind. And so I don't know if you're familiar with Fluxus, but it's really kind of crazy. Anything goes art.
Okay. So very abstract?
No, it's really object-based, and it's also performative.
Okay.
And so I saw this huge exhibition, and I just remember this one wall. I wish I knew who the artist was. But there were all these holes in the wall, and so you'd stick your hand in the wall. So it was very, like... a little scary.
Yeah. But don't know what you're going to, to feel.
Yes. But I don't know. There was something magical about it. Like, it really expanded my ideas about what art could be at that time.
Right.
I think previously in high school, I was really only focused on realism.
Mm-hmm. So it showed you what types of arts are available.
Yeah. It really expanded my mind and made me excited about art that maybe was difficult or that didn't look like quote-unquote art.
The endless possibilities of what you can do through art. What's next on your plate? Are you curating next? Are you catching up on other work?
Good question. We have a guest curator with us in the fall curating an exhibition called These Creatures by Cindy Rehm. It's a feminist exhibition, group exhibition. This spring we have our annual student invitational exhibition followed by our annual student expo exhibition, both featuring student works.
Where can we find these exact dates and times so people can attend?
Right. You can look online at www.chafee.edu/Wignall.
What would you like to curate one day? Are you taking any steps to that currently?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, actually, I'm working with some colleagues at Chafee to curate an exhibition on zines and zine culture. So I'm really excited about that because I love that it's so democratic. You don't have to have a degree. You don't have to be educated. You know, anybody can make a zine. I like the underground DIY.
I love it.
Punk rock, anything goes.
I really love it. That's great.
Yeah,
that's
so we're really excited about that. That's in a couple of years. So that's a big one.
Well, I'm excited about that. So last but not least, when and where can people see this exhibit?
Yes. So please visit us at Chafee College. We're at 5885 Haven Avenue in Rancho Cucamonga. And we're located on the northeast corner of the campus.
Okay.
You're welcome to visit us online for a campus map. Permits can be purchased in the parking lot for, I think, $1? $2?
Come with two.
Yes, come with two, exactly.
Okay.
Cover all your bases.
Cover all your bases.
The exhibition will be there through March 9th.
So
we're open on Saturdays so that if you work during the week, you're welcome to come by noon to four on Saturdays.
Okay, no excuses.
Right.
Come see Faster Faster. All right. Thank you, Rebecca. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Pleasure interviewing you.
That was Taylor Milliner in conversation with Rebecca Trawick, curator and director at the Wignall Museum on the campus of Chafee College. Again, Faster Faster runs through March 9th, and more at chafee.edu/Wignall/exhibitions. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Just ahead, we have Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Sean McFate, author of Shadow War, the first in a series of thriller fiction in the vein of Tom Clancy. It's the story of an elite American mercenary, and a lot of the adventure in this novel is actually based on the author's own experiences. The book started off as a memoir. Later in the program, I'll be speaking with David Morgan about his new book, Monty Python Speaks, a very recent book. It came from interviews with all the original cast, many of the early collaborators, and more. It's a look at an amazing and silly 30-year spree in TV and film, though the timing of the release hits a 50th anniversary as well. Listening to KVCR, it's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, I'll be speaking with David Morgan about his new book, Monty Python Speaks, with interviews from all the original cast and more. First, though, we have Emmanuel Rogers with some recent thriller fiction.
Joining us now is Sean McFate, author of Shadow War. Sean's book gives us a window into how political intrigue is carried out in our world today. Thanks for joining us, Sean.
Thank you for having me.
You are more than welcome. Now, I do understand you have a co-writer, Brett Witter.
Yeah, Brett's great. Brett co-authored Monuments Men and has several New York Times bestsellers to his name. He and I are a great team.
All right. Now, before we get on about the book, Shadow War, will you tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, and your credentials?
Sure. So my background is a bit odd. I actually started as thinking I was going to be a concert violinist.
Yes.
And at age 9, I went to a musical boarding school in New York City. My goal was to play Carnegie Hall at age 17.
Wow.
Had a midlife crisis at age 13 when I realized I'd never be Itzhak Perlman, no matter how much I practiced. And sort of backwards fell into becoming a paratrooper. And I was in a U.S. Army officer in the 82nd Airborne Division for many years, and then got out of that and became a private military contractor. Some would consider that to be a mercenary in Africa. And in many ways, Shadow War is sort of pulling back the curtain on that world.
This is amazing to me. You had a midlife crisis at 13 because you knew what you wanted to do at 9.
Yeah, well, actually, I knew what I wanted to do at 4.
At four, I
picked up the violin at 3. At 4, I was like, this is what I want to do. And then you get to a point where you're like, I have the passion, but I don't have the talent, which is a really horrible place for anybody to land. But, you know, it pushed me in other directions. In some ways, I think the discipline of the violin really helped me out, strangely, becoming a paratrooper.
Wow. Well, thanks for your service. I do appreciate it. 82nd Airborne, they're some of the heroes of mine. And Sean, we've all heard the term shadow war before. And there's another term in your book, deep state. But what do these terms mean? And what do they mean to each other? What does shadow war and deep state mean? And how do they work together?
Well, you know, deep states, you know, I'm a professor now. I teach at Georgetown University and the National Defense University, which is one of the Pentagon's premier war colleges. And I think in some ways, fiction is a better platform to discuss truth and reality than nonfiction. And one of the ideas that, you know, I wanted to play with in this book, which is based a lot on actual events, is this idea of deep state. And a deep state is a controversial idea. It's basically sort of powers that be that kind of, you know, rule behind the headlines, rule behind governments, their interests, their networks of elites. And it's not a conspiracy. It's not like you know, like a secret organization trying to overthrow something,
right,
like a conspiracy. This is things like, some would say, you know, electoral college or superdelegates or Sunni and Shia interests in the Middle East that rule across borders. And so shadow war explores, like, what happens if there are deep states and they go to war, and those are shadow wars.
Ah, okay. So would I be incorrect if I said Hillary Clinton behind Bill Clinton when he was president?
I'm sure she would agree with that.
Okay.
Well, in the book Shadow War, the sort of the deep states are Putin, which is his own deep state. You know,
yes.
In some ways, you could say Russia is really just a regime, and
yes.
at the head of it is Putin. And sort of the West, you know, when we think of the West, we think of that, you could say, as a deep state. And you could see other deep states in the world, too. There's a Sunni deep state in the Middle East. There's a, you know, a Shia deep state.
Okay.
There's other deep states. And they also compete and go to war. And the current sort of front line between Putin and the West right now is in Ukraine, which is where the novel's set.
Right, right. So how do we get into deep wars in the first place? I mean, have they always been there? Is this something new to modern warfare?
Well, that's a great question. So yes and no. I mean, first of all, when we think of war, when we grew up in, you know, reading about it in seventh grade and stuff, we think of worlds like World War II. We think of, you know, John Wayne, you know, leading Marines to plant a flag in Iwo Jima. We think of state on state using military and the laws of war. That's not how modern wars are, how they work at all. They're, you know, nobody wears a uniform. There's no laws of war.
Right.
And you don't just have states now. You have corporations and super rich people who now can hire mercenaries and have drone fleets. War is no longer just the province of states. Non-states can have wars too, and they do.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, with that background, we have a hero in Shadow War. His name is Tom Locke, and he has many credentials in the modern warfare world. Who is he fashioned after, and why does he put his life on the line for others?
So this book, this novel, began as a memoir, my memoir, having served in, you know, U.S. military and then gone over to the so-called dark side and coming out the other end of it. And Tom Locke, who's the protagonist, is sort of like me had I stayed in, except he's a lot more badass and he's a lot more damaged. His soul's a lot more damaged and dark.
Right.
And he is sent into Ukraine. He's a high-end mercenary. He's sent into Ukraine covertly, and he's on a contract by the U.S. government to secretly sort of, you know, prepare a chosen oligarch to become president of Ukraine and fight Putin. But he gets there and he realizes quickly that the contract is not what he thinks it is, who he's working for is not who he thinks it is, and nothing is as he sees it. And this is sort of, you know, part of it is to sort of see, like, what do shadow wars really look like? And they're going on all over the world. And also, you know, other machinations back in Washington, in London, in Houston, other places that get to dictate what goes on.
Right. Now, I want our audience to understand what you were just saying there, because you said the hero, Tom Locke, is much more bad than you are. But our audience doesn't know. There are many who compare you as being the American James Bond. So how much more dangerous does Tom Locke have to be?
know, right? Well, I would never say I'm the American James Bond. James Bond, I grew up in, I love James Bond.
Right.
But that type of hero, this, you know, what makes Locke interesting are his flaws. And he's very human. He's not like, you know, there's no Locke babes or Bond girls in this book. I mean, this is all, it's based on real things and real life happenings, and things do go wrong. And his, even though he can sort of, he's like Jason Bourne, where he can punch his way out of every situation if he had to,
right.
But his greatest weapon's his mind. It's trying to be shrewd and cunning and outsmarting his foes, which there are many.
That's author Sean McFate in conversation with Manuel Rogers. We're hearing about Shadow War, the first in a series of thriller fiction available online and in retail. More at seanmcfate.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
How does Tom Locke get involved, I mean, with going to save someone in the Ukraine? And why are they so important? Why are they so important? Couldn't he just pick? I mean, now that they figure they can put whoever they want in there, why can't they just pick anybody?
Yeah, so this is interesting. So, you know, Locke, he's like the, you know, he leads a team of mercenaries that are like special operations mercenaries, and these mercenaries are from all over the world, which is the way it really is.
Right.
You know, it's not like you work with just American mercenaries. You work with people from Thailand, from everywhere. And his boss, Brad Winters, is the CEO of this private military company. And, you know, Brad Winters is like this ultimate schemer. He's like this brilliant brilliant and slightly evil and extremely ambitious person.
Right.
And he's playing off, you know, like, you know, again, Washington, D.C. against London, New York against Houston. You know, he's playing everybody off for his own ends. And if you can imagine a CEO with a private military behind them who is very ambitious,
right,
that is who, and, you know, and Locke kind of falls into his machinations as this trap as well. And it's never really clear to Locke until the very end what's going on.
Yeah, and okay, before we get on to more of this relationship with Brad Winters and Locke, Sean, will you share with our audience how they can get in contact with you or where they can find information on your book and your work?
Well, thank you. So you can buy Shadow War on Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or bookstores anywhere. There's a Kindle version. There's an audio version. And you can contact me and look a little bit about what I've done beyond Shadow War at my website, which is SeanMcFate.com.
Got it. All right. And it's a wonderful site. You have a lot of interesting things going on there. I've checked it out. So a lot of people would enjoy it. And you share some things about yourself and the modern warfare that many of us really just don't get. But you put it in such clear language. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Work hard on that, so I really appreciate that.
All right. Well, now, back to Tom, because Tom has some issues as far as in this type of work, there are going to be trust issues. But working with Brad Winters, how does he reconcile some of these things that are going on without giving too much away?
Well, you know, when I was in this industry, it's funny what happens. When you're a soldier, you fight for your country. You don't work for the military, you serve and sacrifice for a nation and a way of life. When you become a private military contractor or mercenary, that is inverted. You take that sacred relationship and it becomes transactional.
Wow.
And Locke, after doing this for many years, is numb to all, you know, to the cause. He doesn't care about the cause. What he cares about is being a professional soldier, which is kind of amoral in many ways. And throughout the course of the book, that gets tested. And he tries to wrestle with this, to what does it mean to be a professional who doesn't care? And does he, maybe he does care. And by the end of the book, things happen for him.
Now, you have known actual mercenaries, as you said. With Tom, is he doing it for the money or is that secondary?
That's secondary for him. Now, you know, when I was actually in the industry, there's all sorts of reasons why people join, you know, do this, you know, and actually put their life in danger. Some of it's for the money. Some of it is for the adventure, and some of it is because people don't know any other life, you know. And you have this tragically right now. You have vets coming back from overseas. They have trouble integrating back into civilian society, and they then go out again. They work for a private military firm, maybe not doing what Tom Locke is doing, which is very high-end and aggressive. Maybe they're doing some basic stuff in northern Iraq because that's all they know. And then there are some people who are just dark souls. They want to do things because they want to go rogue. Locke sees all this. He's doing it because he's a professional, but he, at some level, doesn't even know why he keeps on doing it. And that's a big question for him at the beginning of the book.
Right. Right. Now, this is amazing because, again, with the gentleman that he goes to rescue, he and his family in the Ukraine, this is a very important man in the Ukraine. Why can't, you know, in these shadow wars, why can't you pick people who are relatively unknown, who are not as powerful, and use them more as puppets? Why pick somebody that can actually do something to back himself?
Well, it's interesting. So Locke is sent covertly into Ukraine to locate this oligarch, who's a young oligarch,
mm-hmm.
and the idea is that the U.S. wants to back this oligarch to become president. And the oligarch says, sure, but first you must get my family to safety, to get him out of Ukraine beyond the reach of Vladimir Putin. And that's partly what Locke has to do when he,
right,
and he does it. The reason why you can't just take anybody is because, at least in Ukraine, you're either an oligarch or you're nobody.
Oh.
You know?
Okay.
And if you want to have any sort of political, I mean, the parliament of the Ukraine, especially during the time of this, which was like spring of 2014, again, based on real life experiences and
right,
events, you know, the entire parliament was mostly oligarchs. And if you want to be a political player, you have to be an oligarch.
You know, there's something very interesting about this that mirrors real life. And I have to ask you, You know, as Tom Locke is an elite warrior working for Apollo Outcomes, one of the world's most successful private contracting firms, how important in today's world are private contractors in modern warfare?
That's great. So first of all, Apollo Outcomes is a fictional company, but it's modeled after some real companies.
Yes. So
America is increasingly outsourcing its wars. If you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, over half of the military personnel were contractors.
Right.
Right? I mean, and this creates a strategic dependency in the private sector to go to war, which is terrible. Also, you know, most of those contractors are not even American. I mean, only a minority of the contractors were American.
Wow.
So what does it mean when you're having people from other countries coming to do your fighting and dying for you? And the reason, of course, that America contracted out most of those wars is because not enough Americans wanted to volunteer
right.
to fight them in the first place.
Right. So is this the way we're going? Is this something that's going to get bigger, do you see?
So stepping back from being an author and going back to being a professor in
right.
think tanks, I do get asked this a lot. You know, is this the new American way of war? Contract. You know, will future wars be 80% contracted, 90% contracted? I think we have to assume that probably, or at least that's a good possibility of that. You know, unless you have a Vietnam draft where everybody's got to serve,
right.
we're going to have, as long as we're going to be a global superpower with, you know, force projection, we're going to have to fill the ranks. Those will be contractors. So I think this, what it's done, of course, it's created a worldwide industry of mercenaries. And Putin is hiring them, Nigeria, you know, Middle East. These mercenaries are everywhere. And Locke, Shadow War is sort of pulls back the curtain again on what that world actually looks like.
That's amazing. You know, our time is up, Sean. I really do appreciate talking to you because your book, Shadow War, is very well written. And I like it that it's descriptive in such a way I can see the things in my mind that you're describing. So I want to thank you for sharing this very well-written book.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
You are more than welcome. And do you plan on putting on more garb and going back into the military, or are you going to write some more?
I think my military days are over. No, but we do have a second book coming out in a year from now, which is a sequel to this book, and hopefully there'll be more books in the series.
We look forward to having you back here to talk about it.
Thank you very much. I look forward to that, too.
Thank you. You have a great day.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Sean McFate, author of Shadow War. Again, available online and in retail. More at seanmcfate.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. As KVCR continues, we'll hear from David Morgan. We'll hear about his new book, Monty Python Speaks. It came from interviews from all the original cast and some collaborators, billed as a look at an amazing and silly 30-year spree in TV and film. Rounding out the program tonight, I'll be speaking with David Morgan. His new book is called Monty Python Speaks, marking a 50th anniversary for Monty Python, with interviews from all the original cast and some of the early collaborators as well. What marks the 50th anniversary of Monty Python? Is it just this year, or is there an actual broadcast date?
Well, it was in October of 1969 that their show Monty Python's Flying Circus debuted on the BBC, so that would technically be the 50th anniversary.
Some folks may have known of this book already in its previous form, so what we have here for this 50th anniversary, this revised and updated version, so some of the things that are included with this updated version, I definitely want to hear about some of these. For example, the foreword by John Oliver. I did read that he first saw Monty Python when he was about 10, then Life of Brian when he was in middle school. I think something to occupy the class on a rainy day. How did you end up with John Oliver writing the foreword for this, please?
Well, he was a big fan of the Pythons, naturally. They were a huge influence on him. And a few years ago at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York City, he was the moderator for a panel discussion, a Q&A, with all the Pythons at a 40th anniversary screening of Monty Python, the Holy Grail. And it was a very anarchic Q&A where nobody was really paying attention to each other. It was hilarious. But he wrote a foreword for this book, and where he spoke about the influence not only on himself, but on whole generations of comedy writers in the Pythons.
Okay, nice. Well, let's talk about briefly where the cast had been before getting together. Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Gilliam, Eric Idle, mm-hmm. and Jones and Palin there. Yeah, where had they been?
Yeah, well, most of them had attended and gotten to know each other at Cambridge and Oxford universities, where they had all written and performed in comedy reviews among the students. And after graduation, rather than pursue careers in law or medicine, they all joined the BBC writing comedy for radio and TV. And so they all worked with each other in various groupings on several TV shows, including for David Frost. And it was in 1969 that BBC gave them an opportunity to write and perform in their own series. And the BBC gave them an extraordinary freedom and basically said, you can do whatever you want. And the Pythons did whatever they wanted.
Yeah, they did.
And it was quite revolutionary for TV at the time, because they didn't adhere to any standard formats for TV, for sketch comedy. Sketches, for example, didn't even use punchlines. They didn't follow narratives. They didn't have recurring characters. It was just a sort of explosion of one comic idea following another, all tied together with surreal animated bits. It was unlike anything that was seen on television up to that point, and we hadn't really seen anything like it since.
Do you know if when they were given free rein, which I'm sure there were people regretting that. But I love Python.
Afterwards, they were like, what have we done?
Yeah. Any kind of blowback as far as, oh, this is about to get canceled, and then it kept on going, you know, people loved it enough.
It did have a strong following, but of course, as more and more TV executives paid attention to what the Pythons were doing, they started getting more and more worried, and that's when they ran into some censorship issues, where the executives might say, oh, you can't possibly broadcast that. And so the Pythons did engage in some battles with the TV executives about what they could or could not include in the shows. And interestingly, in 1974, after it first appeared on PBS here in the U.S., the American TV network, ABC, bought six episodes of Python. They wanted to show it late at night at 11:30 at night. But, of course, they had to cut bits of it, not just to make room for commercials, but also for network standards and practices. So they were cutting out stuff from the shows that they were saying, oh, we can't possibly broadcast this on American television. Things like the word naughty bits. Like ABC was telling the Pythons, we can't air the word naughty bits at 11:30 at night. The Pythons took them to court in New York City and sued them. And the ultimate result of that court battle was that the Pythons won control of all of their TV shows.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Wow. And so what kind of major changes then started happening once they were in control? You do address this to a certain extent, although I think we may be talking about Life of Brian or one of the movies, but once they got control.
Yeah, it's more the movies.
Yeah. For the show then?
Yeah. Well, for the show, they controlled the show, and they were able to keep that close to their chest. And but the movies, their first experience with the movie was enough for something completely different, where they were basically asked to recreate some of their popular TV sketches, the idea being that they were going to sell this film to America, because they thought it would never sell on American television, but we can show this film at college campuses around the country and build an audience base. And it didn't really do well in America. It actually did better in the UK, where everyone had already seen those same sketches on television. But then they decide they wanted to direct their own film with their own new material, and that's where they came up with Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which was as much about making fun of the process of making movies as it was a movie about the legend of King Arthur. And then they followed that with The Life of Brian, which was even more ambitious for them because it had more of a story and a central character, and it, certainly the subject matter was more ambitious for them. And they faced their greatest censorship battles with that film as a result.
Sure, yes, absolutely. That is, and it's hard to decide what a favorite is. It depends on if you're wanting a narrative or just a 90-minute version of the TV show, and in that case, now for something completely different, for something like that. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming in conversation with David Morgan. His new book is Monty Python Speaks, out quite recently, marking a 30-year spree and hitting a 50th anniversary for Monty Python. The interviews that you conducted with all of the Pythons, were they all in preparation for this book, or had you interviewed some already and they became material for the book? You know what I'm saying there? Chicken or egg, I suppose.
Yeah. I had started interviewing one or another beginning in the mid-80s. I've been on the set of many of Terry Gilliam's films. So I've known the Pythons going back even to the 70s. But when I started work on the book, I did a whole new round of interviews with many of them, as well as the people they worked with on the TV shows and in the films. And then for this update, I've done new interviews with them, as well as with Hank Azaria, who was a Tony nominee for the Broadway musical Spamalot. So that sort of brought us up to date with what they'd been doing in the 21st century.
Well, that could have easily been a sidebar into The Simpsons had we been afforded more time. Oh, my gosh. But, well, did you ever interview George Harrison?
Yeah, a lot of ground to cover with Hank Azaria.
Oh, yeah, you got that right. What about George Harrison? Did you ever speak with him? Certainly not in the updates, of course.
With who?
George Harrison.
No, unfortunately, because we lost George a while back.
Yes, not the updated interviews, of course, but
yeah.
Well, I'm curious about, maybe you could speak of his involvement just briefly, because we would see and hear his name here and there. I even saw him as a reporter, meet the Ruddles. There's so much there.
He was a big fan of the Pythons from when they first were aired, and he was also big friends with Eric Idle, and he actually contributed to Eric's TV special, The Ruddles, which was done for NBC television, which was a hilarious sort of fake documentary inspired by the Beatles. And in 1978, when the Pythons were trying to get funding for Life of Brian, they actually had funding from EMI, but then the heads of EMI pulled it because they thought, we don't want to be involved in a blasphemous film. And so they were scurrying around trying to replace the funding that they had lost. They were ready to shoot in Tunisia. And George Harrison mortgaged his house. And Eric asked, you know, why are you doing this for us? And George said, because I want to see the movie. And so he did. So he paid to have Life of Brian shot. And, you know, thanks to him. It's a wonderful film, and we wouldn't have it if it weren't for him.
Oh, my goodness. I'm glad that he had control of the mortgage at that point. Oh, my gosh, that is phenomenal. I understand even the Lumberjack song was produced at Harrison Studio. So there's that may be a closer for the song coming out of this. But so there's, I guess, two things to address rather quickly. One, you have a chapter. It's the If You Could Save Only One Thing chapter. And that's, gosh, I mean, what a question. I may be stealing that at some point. But let's not mention what Eric Idle had to say, what he would say.
Yeah, that's very personal.
Yeah, very, very, that's personal is the best way to say it. What were some of the shockers beyond Eric Idle? Or maybe some that you predicted they might say?
Well, I was kind of surprised that they were so sort of unattached to what they have created, which means so much to us Python fans. I mean, I would run into a burning warehouse to save something from Python if that were the only existing copy of it. And yet they seem to be, oh, let it all burn. They didn't seem as attached, and that kind of surprised me. It was almost as if the process of creating it was more important for them than the actual final result.
Gosh. I could see that with Gilliam sitting in the corner with his animation just quietly by himself to a certain extent. But, yeah, that would be a strange one. Well, okay, you know what? This is, 15 minutes already. So I'm going to close it out with this way. Sometimes when a person just mentions Monty Python, it will cause a series of quotes to start coming forth from the 3 or 4, 7 folks standing there. So I want to know about your favorite quote or go-to line. People will undoubtedly come out with Nish, the knights that go Nish, or she turned me into a newt, or something from the series itself. How about you?
I don't know if I have one line, one Python quote, but throughout the book, all the chapter subheads in the book are all Python quotes that felt germane to whatever the passage is that they were separating. And that seemed to be the way for the Python sensibility to speak out among the crevices of the interview quotes. I'm surprised sometimes at what quotes do pop up in your mind at the most inopportune moments, and you realize that's from Monty Python. That's something I heard 50 years ago. That's frightening.
yeah, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. Well, then I guess as a real closer, we have to cut off in seconds. While this book was an update of a previous work, were there items discovered that could lead to, say, not a part two per se, but something related? Maybe a book on Brazil. You know, I don't know.
I don't know about related, but I think this just speaks to the timelessness of Python. The audience, it keeps finding new generations of fans, even 50 years on, and I think it's the timeless quality of the humor that lends itself to that. So I think that the Pythons will continue to attract new fans long after they are gone, and that's a testament to their innovation and their intelligence and their silliness.
That was David Morgan, author of Monty Python Speaks, available at bookstores and many online retailers. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KBC Arts. Thanks once again to David Morgan and to Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with author Sean McFates, author of Shadow War. Thanks also to Rebecca Trowick, curator and director of the Wignall Museum on the campus of Chaffey College. Here at KBCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Lillian Vasquez, Taylor Milliner, Isel Quapio, Benjamin Perper, Sharina Watt, and KBCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KBCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So, as always, thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KBC Arts programs via podcast at kbcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kbcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.